You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. If you're empowered with your money, chances are you're saving and investing and planning for your future. But are you budgeting the way you should be? Learn more at planefe.com/hermoney and schedule your complimentary wealth checkup today.
Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
You're in your 50s and kind of trying to imagine what that next decade looks like, you can start planting seeds now, even in your 60s, that might lead you to an off-ramp that helps you embrace all the benefits that come with working, not just financial, and maybe think about developing a roadmap that will get you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Jean Chatsky. Thank you so much for joining me today on Her Money. I've been posting more on my social channels lately, maybe you've noticed, and one of my TikToks recently, I don't know if you could call it going viral, but it did really well, where I talk about Peak 65, also known as the silver tsunami. If you haven't heard about it, it's the fact that more people are turning 65 this year than at any point in history. Why is this important? Well, it's going to have a huge impact on our economy, on Social Security, on the upcoming election, but it also has a lot to do with retirement, your retirement, my retirement, the retirement world as we speak now and in the future, which is why I thought we would talk today about retirement and whether the thought of it or even the word gives you nervous butterflies or is the kind of thing that you want to just push off to the back of your mind. The truth is, thinking about retirement can feel surprisingly disempowering, and that's despite the endless commercials showing golf courses and grandkids and sailboats and long walks out into the sunsets and so many other cliches. And that's because there's so much bad information out there that tells us how woefully unprepared we are and how little we need to spend when we retire if we want to have enough to make it through those golden years and have a good time simultaneously. Whether you are turning 65 this year, like 4.1 million people, or whether you're just starting to think about how much you're going to have saved up, I'm here to tell you that retirement doesn't have to be so scary. Planning for retirement doesn't have to be so scary. It can be empowering. It can honestly be fun if you focus on the dreaming of all of it. Ann Lester is former head of retirement solutions for JP Morgan Asset Management. She says she's never been so good at saving, despite winning the prestigious Ray Lillywhite Award for her extraordinary lifetime contributions to Americans' economic security. She says she didn't start thinking about her own retirement until her second son was born. She cops to all of this and more in her new book, Your Best Financial Life, Save Smart Now for the Future You Want, where she talks about how she got out of that dangerous cycle and was actually able to retire early on her own terms. Before I welcome Anne to the show, one quick announcement. The Her Money Podcast is now on YouTube, so you can watch me and all of our guests there. Subscribe, share, and like your favorite episodes. Anne Lester, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Jean, for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Congrats on the book.
Thank you. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So you have worked in finance. You have helped people essentially save for their retirements your entire career. But in your 20s, you had maxed out all your credit cards. You were in a ton of debt. And as I said in the intro, you said it wasn't until your second child was born that you actually started thinking about a 401k. Tell us about your financial origin story.
You know, I think it's a combination for everybody of nature and nurture, right? So we are born with a certain genetic predisposition to saving, to spending, to your ability to control impulses. I will just say right now, I would have failed the marshmallow test completely. I have very poor impulse control. I just do. So whether it's the cookie or the thing that I want to buy, like I'm like, oh, goody, that sounds like fun. And it's funny because it's true about me. If I'm a fiduciary managing other people's money, that's different. That's not mine. So it's interesting the way our brains work. So I'm kind of wired as a spender. And then there's the nurture side of it, right? So that's the nature. How am I wired? The nurture side is very interesting. My parents were born in the early 30s. They, you know, were children of the Depression. There was just no money for them growing up. And so they never spent what they didn't have. They were very frugal people. And I grew up, my dad was a college professor, my mom taught nursery school, comfortable growing up. But I don't ever remember hearing any conversations about how much we could afford to spend on anything. All I heard and learned were, these are good things to spend money on, and these are bad things to spend money on. So what I internalized was, there's enough money for the things that align with value. So there was money for music lessons for me. There was no money for buying the cool pair of shoes that everybody else had at school, right? That we don't spend money on that end. We spend money on things like music lessons. But it was never, we have a finite amount of money and we're making choices with this finite amount of money. So I guess the other thing that I think was particularly dangerous for people my age, I graduated in the mid-80s from college, was that was when credit card companies started heavily marketing credit cards to college students. And my parents didn't have credit cards, right? It just wasn't a thing. And so I think now, certainly people coming out of college in their 20s and 30s are a lot more sophisticated. They may still struggle, but I think we understand a little bit better how this works. So, and there's certainly a lot more information about it. And I think, in fact, those card companies aren't able to market quite the same way they were. So I think that's a little less difficult. But I immediately, you know, I started working in politics. I earned very little money. And I just didn't have enough. And my framing was, if I can hit the minimum payment on my card, I can afford it.
Yeah.
Right? Which is just not really true.
It's so funny. You're talking about the marketing on college campuses. And I'm flashing on when I was in college, too, in the mid-80s. I think I got my credit card junior year. And for signing up, I got one of those big 2-pound bags of M&Ms. That's all they had to give me.
Oh, there's nothing not to love there, right?
That, yeah. That is all they had to give me to get me to sign on the dotted line. Other people got T-shirts or big bottles of soda. I mean, it was just such a low bar to get you to sign away your financial future. And I ended up in credit card debt as well, so I completely understand it. How old were you when your second child was born and when you had this eye-opening experience?
Well, so the thing is, I was 37, and I vividly remember thinking, I set up an IRA. We lived in Italy, so I didn't have access to a 401k plan, and I was in the sort of official Italian retirement system, which when you move across borders, it really also messes up your retirement savings. But, you know, I'd signed up for the 401k plan, but I hadn't actually paid any attention to it. I had no idea how much I was contributing. And I remember thinking, well, okay, I've got two kids. I really have to like get serious about this adult stuff. Like, I can't mess around with this anymore. And trying to figure out what to do was so stressful. And I found the language that was then, 401k plans are a lot easier to use now, but
yes.
Back then it was so difficult and confusing. And I had to answer all these questions. And I vividly remember one of the questions being, what do I think the rate of inflation will be between now and when I retire? And I was just like, I am out. I'm done. I'm going to go do the dishes. This is nuts. And so I kind of realized I needed to do something, but it took like another 6 months or a year before I was like, all right, I really got to do this now. And actually the trick for me was not like finally growing up. I actually, as a work obligation, really was asked to try to figure out how to help people invest for retirement. And that was what unlocked everything for me. Because I started learning about behavioral economics and this brain wiring. And for me, that was, I don't want to say a get out of jail free card, but it was such a powerful thing for me to go, oh, I'm not stupid. I'm actually not even irresponsible. This is just the way I'm wired. It's like my height. Like, I'm just like this. And I stopped blaming myself. When you're trying to do something, maybe it's an A-type personality thing, I set up little challenges for myself. And I do this with food too. Like, I can put the cookies on the counter and not eat them. Not, right? I can't. I can have money and have it sitting in my checking account and not spend it. Not. I can decide every month that I'll save X. Not. I can't do that. I'm bad at it.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, most people are bad at it. And the work that you did with behavioral economics and other people digging into this combo platter of we have to save and we're not good at saving, so let's figure it out, has really revolutionized the retirement system. But we started the show talking a bit about Peak 65 and how it's a real challenge for people. And so I want to talk about what you learned in your career, but also in putting together this book that can help people succeed, whether they want an early retirement, a later retirement, a lavish retirement, or a comfortable retirement. So let's start with people who are still in the accumulation phase. Let's start with people who've got a little bit of road to run. What are the boxes that you should be checking now in order to get yourself situated for that comfortable, let's just go for comfortable, retirement sometime in your 60s-ish?
There are an enormous number of ways to figure this out. I put a super simplified version of this in my book. One rule of thumb that a lot of people cite is you should have saved up 10 times your annual income if you want to be able to replicate your lifestyle comfortably. And many people think that's sort of 80%-ish of your pre-retirement income. So if you're earning $100,000 a year, that means you should have saved up $1 million, let's say, by the time you retire-ish. And that means the money you can generate from that $1 million, whether it's using lifetime income opportunities, whether it's combining that with maybe some withdrawal strategies, plus Social Security, should give you 80% of what you were living on before, which once you take out the reduced costs of you're not commuting, you're not saving for retirement anymore, and a few other things, is a useful rule of thumb, right? The answer is it depends for everybody, but that's a good sort of rough starting place. And then I think as you get closer and closer to that, it can make a lot of sense to check out some more sophisticated calculators. And your financial services provider has one, your 401k platform has one. There are a whole bunch of other ones online, but doing a little more refined planning makes sense when you get closer. So then the big question is, like, how are you doing?
How do you get there? Yeah.
And if you are in your 20s and you are saving 10 to 15% of your gross income and your employer is matching a little bit of that, you'll be fine. And you're investing in something like what I used to do for a living, which is a target date fund, but you're investing in sort of an appropriately return and risk-oriented profile. So again, if you're in your 20s, most people would say that should be 90-ish percent, maybe 95% equities, and then you should gradually get more conservative. If you're doing that in your 20s, 10 to 15%, you'll be fine. You want to keep checking, but you're fine. Most people aren't saving that much, right? I think the median savings rate, right? If you draw a line of how everybody's saving, the middle point is somewhere between 6 and 8% for people in their 20s. It creeps up to 8 to 10% for people in their 50s. And that means many people are behind. So question number one is, how are you doing? Are you on track? If you're not on track, you need to save a little more money if you want to retire in your mid-60s comfortably. So that leads to a little bit of a reckoning with yourself, right? Like, okay, how am I going to save a little more money? Got to spend less money. Or you need to work longer, which may or may not be something that's under your control. So that first point of reckoning is an important one. And I'll just be honest, the younger you do that, the easier it is to course correct and the smaller the relative sacrifice will be if you still want to achieve that goal.
It was interesting to me. You said in your conversations with young people, the ones who are most on track for retirement are those who are talking with their friends about money. I mean, why does having those conversations psychologically make us better savers?
I think it's kind of the classic, like, what you don't know is the really hard thing to deal with. And it's what you're often the most afraid of. And it's makes me think of the monster under the bed when you're a kid. Like, it's so terrifying to look. And then once you look, it's like, oh, that's a really large dust bunny. That's the guitar case that I kicked under there 3 years ago and forgot, like whatever it is. Right. So knowing the scope and the shape of the problem, I think, suddenly makes it less scary. I do think there's an enormous amount of very positive things that you can find talking to family, friends, and peers, even social media, podcasts like this, for instance, right? You can learn an enormous amount. And it just starts desensitizing us to the fear of actually understanding what's going on. And I hope I'm no longer part of the problem. I used to be part of the problem. I think the financial services industry, partly because we think and talk about this stuff all day long, and partly because many people in it have always understood how it works, think this is really cool and fun and geek out and want to share their like geeky enthusiasm. And we use language that's confusing, that is disempowering, that makes people feel guilty, that makes them feel ashamed to ask questions. So the more you just familiarize with stuff, the more you get comfortable asking questions, I think the more it lets you take power over your own actions in finances.
We talked a little bit about behavioral finance and the behavioral finance innovations that have helped people get on track and stay on track. The big three in my book are auto-enrollment into retirement plans, which the SECURE Act now says employers have to do. You can opt out if you want.
If it's a new plan, they don't have to do it for an existing plan. So watch out for that one.
Okay. All right. Good to know. Second on the list, target date funds, which you'll be often defaulted into as an investment and can keep you on track without rebalancing because they kind of do it for you. And the third is auto escalation. And auto escalation is where once you're in the retirement plan, your contribution is bumped up on a regular basis. Do you find that people are actually using that? I mean, to me, one big reason that people undersave is because they are defaulted into these plans at a 3% savings rate and never think to adjust it.
So I actually misspoke. The thing that is not mandatory is the auto enrollment is there. If you have a plan, you have to auto enroll. What Secure 2.0 also says, which is fabulous, is if you're setting up a new plan, you have to auto escalate.
Explain auto escalation, sort of where it came from and why it's important.
So as you just said, there's a real danger in getting people automatically signed up if you don't also automatically increase how much their savings. And I heard this in my focus group and it literally made my hair stand up when I was, you know, behind the mirrored wall and I was like, "Oh, if you get signed up and you get put in at 3%, which is a very common default rate, and the only reason companies use this is the IRS used 3%. It's a beautiful example of behavioral economics in action. The IRS used 3% as an example in a letter that they explained how it worked. And that's kind of turned into the number everybody thinks is the right number to start at, right? Because it was in an example. Terrifying. So what happens is companies sign people up at 3%. They often match half of that, so 1.5%. So you're saving 4.5%, which is well below the 10 to 15% that you should be saving. And because people have been auto-enrolled, they often don't even know they're participating. And if they do know they're participating, they think because the company signed them up at that level, it must be okay. So in fact, in one of my focus groups, somebody said, you know, and I was looking at how much people were saving and whether or not they thought that was enough. And you could come up with this 2x2 matrix. And there was this really interesting group of people who thought they were doing everything right and were not. And a large reason for that was they were getting automatically enrolled at 3%. And they said, oh, well, it must be enough because that's what my company did for me. Right? So absolutely terrifying. Auto escalation is when a company automatically increases how much they're taking out of your paycheck, often once a year. The best way to do it, and I think this is very common, is to time that increase with when you get a raise so that you don't feel that you're losing money with this higher savings rate. And in fact, that's one of the best tips ever is be aggressive about increasing how much you're saving when you're getting raises because it doesn't hurt very much. But that auto escalation is critically important. If you're 23, you don't have to start saving 15% of your salary on day one. If you can, fabulous, do it, like 100%. But most people struggle with that. You could start at 3 or 5. Just get there over 10 years, you'll be fine.
Fantastic. We are going to take a very quick break when we come back. And I want to dig into the people on the later end of the curve and what we have to do to catch up if we're behind or deal with the fact that we may be retired earlier than we expect. So we're going to take a quick break. Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. You're saving, you're investing, and you're ready to embrace a bright financial future. But when was the last time you took a look at your budget? It may be time for you to prioritize different saving strategies and what they mean for your overall financial future, because knowing exactly how your budget is allocated can make all the difference when it comes to your financial health and wellness. Learn more at planefe.com/hermoney. And schedule your complimentary wealth checkup today. We are back with Ann Lester, author of the new book, Your Best Financial Life. So for the younger people, we've established get to 10 to 15%, you'll be fine. I just love the you'll be fine of it all because it's very clear. It's very encouraging. It's sort of like you can do this now and down the road, things will work themselves out, even if you don't know exactly what you're saving for. But then there are people who are already there. There is the Peak 65 generation. Peak 65, as the Alliance for Lifetime Income calls it. There are people in their 50s who are going to be, as you write in your book, retired a lot earlier than they expect. You point to a survey in the book from the 2023 Retirement Survey of Workers, and it showed that the median age that workers 50 and older expect to retire is 67, yet more than half retire sooner than they planned. What happens?
What happens is people get laid off, companies change, people's health declines, a spouse's health declines. If you're in your late 50s or early 60s, your parents' health declines, if you're lucky enough to have parents as I am. If I had not retired from JP Morgan in 2020, I would have had to have taken at least a 3 or 4 month leave of absence that over the summer because my mother, who's now almost 90, fell and badly broke her arm. And I had to drop everything and fly out and take care of her. And it was COVID and there was a lot of craziness going on. But it would have been really hard to hold down my full time. I'd already announced I was leaving and I was, you know, still working, but it was I could manage that. I could not have managed my former job. That just would not have happened. And things like that happen to people in their 50s and 60s, not on schedule. And it's one of the most heartbreaking things out there for oneself, which is to look back on decisions that you made and go, wow, if I had understood the consequence of that decision, I don't know that I would have made that decision. That's why I wrote the book. But here you are. Like, all right, what do we do? Like I said earlier, you have to make some really hard decisions about what you're going to stop spending money on. And ideally, you do this while you still have a job.
Well, in the book, you talk about having what you call an oh shit fund. And you put together a checklist for having one, and it's to help you through situations like this. So what is it? I mean, is it just your emergency fund, or is it different?
It's absolutely your emergency fund. So I called it the oh shit fund. Literally, my husband and I had just bought our first home, and we'd had it inspected, and we were told we'd have to replace the roof in a few years, and that was fine. And literally, I don't know, 3 or 4 months after closing, we woke up and it was raining in our bedroom. To which we responded, oh shit, like now what? We just spent all of our money on the down payment and closing. Like, we didn't have an emergency fund. So if you're thinking about buying a house, don't spend all of your money. Tip number one. So that oh shit fund is there for expenses that are unexpected, that have to be paid, and have to be paid now. And the conventional wisdom, it is an emergency savings fund. The conventional wisdom is 3 to 6 months salary. The reason many people talk about that number is that should cover the period that it will take you to find a new job. Right. So that's kind of the ultimate bad news scenario. And then we can layer in all sorts of other horrible things that happen, massive home repairs, replacing a car, medical emergencies, et cetera. But like, that job loss is how that 3 to 6 month number is typically calculated. And if you've got an emergency fund and you're faced with an unexpected job loss in your late 50s or 60s, I think a real question to ask yourself is, how likely do you think it is that you'll be able to fully replace your former income? And I think many people discover that it isn't. I wish the world were not that way, but it is. And I'm retired, right? I retired early. I am very engaged in the world, and I am still working, right, as a board member, writing this book, giving speeches, right? I'm still earning income. I'm retired from corporate life. I'm still earning income. And part of my financial plan is I need to keep earning income until I'm well into my 60s. And it's also more fun. But that's part of my financial plan.
So if you go through that calculus and you discover I'm probably not going to replace my entire income, what's the game plan? I mean, do something, right? Figure out what you can do to replace as much as possible.
In hindsight, right, it's ideal to have a little bit of a game plan. And I've always had that game plan, maybe because I never felt super financially secure. Like, if something goes wrong, like, what's the list of stuff I stop? Just stop. I guess I initially did this. If you work in financial services, your income can be quite volatile from year to year. And we had a couple of bad years in my team in 2001, 2002, and then 2008, 9, 10. And so I always knew that was a risk. And so it's like, what do I need to basically keep the lights on and keep us fed? And then what's everything else? And so I think if you've mentally done that checklist and started identifying discretionary spending, right? Discretionary is a loaded word because everybody's definition of what's discretionary and non-discretionary is a little different, but you can approach this two ways. What are the things that you know you could just stop doing and really not miss them? Like, how many streaming services do you have? Those are easy, right? It's not a ton of money, but it does add up. How often are you eating out, right? You can pretty quickly go down the list of, have you planned some vacations? Those are kind of easy, right? You can go through this list of things that you consider sort of things you normally pay for that you might not think about discretionary and have a game plan for where you start cutting. I think that's a very healthy thing to keep current regardless of what you think your financial situation would be. And so I had choice about when I chose to retire. But if you are in an industry that's facing layoffs, if you know your company's not doing well, if you feel yourself slowing down and just kind of getting fatigued with all of this, it's a really good thing to have. It's like a financial equivalent of a go bag. What do I know I can just start cutting off immediately? And then, Jean, you mentioned a second question. If you are planning on retiring in your 60s and you're a little short of your goals, that list then can serve as the, all right, well, where do I want to start? What's going to be relatively easy to give up? What's going to be, I won't love it, but no big deal. And then what's going to be actually painful?
The other side of the equation is that you could keep working. We know data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows us that the labor force is expected to grow by about 96% by the year 2030, which is around the corner, for people who are 75 and up. Is that because people are getting to that retirement point and realizing they don't have enough money? Or is it that they want to keep working, want to stay engaged, or a combo platter of both?
I think it's the combo platter. I think there are a whole bunch of things that are sort of sweepingly true, and yet for every individual, it's a very individual story. So it really depends on what you're doing for work, whether you like it, whether you're physically or mentally capable of continuing to do it, and then whether your employer or another one has a need for your skill set, right? So I do think that a huge reason people are working longer is that many people are lucky enough to be physically and mentally strong and are looking at longer lifespans. And let's remember that 65, that was the traditional age for retirement, which is when Social Security used to turn on, was the actuarial expected age of death when we did that, which is the equivalent of that would be 85 today, right? So, all right, that kind of reframes it right there. Now, many people are not in good health. Many people are not in jobs that they can physically do. So I think we have to be a little, leave some space for that. But I do think there's a host of very real benefits for staying engaged, maybe not at the prior level, right? Maybe not in a 40 or 50 or 60 hour week job like I was doing, or 70 or whatever it was, right? I did not want to keep doing that for forever, certainly not even in my late 50s. But many people just love what they're like. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing right now until I literally can't, because I'm having fun. It's interesting. I'm with great people. I have fascinating conversations. I'm earning some money, right? Those are all important to me. I think it's something like 40% of those people that are working beyond traditional retirement age are doing it because they need the money, and that's the only reason they're doing it. I think 20% were only doing it because it was fun and they were enjoying themselves, and the other 40% was yes and. That feels kind of reasonable to me. But again, I think it's an interesting thing to think about. Again, if you're in your 50s and kind of trying to imagine what that next decade looks like, you can start planting seeds now, even in your 60s, that might lead you to an off-ramp that helps you embrace all the benefits that come with working, not just financial, and maybe think about developing a roadmap that will get you there.
Let's end this conversation where we started it, with peak 65 and the fact that it is going to reverberate through the world. It's going to have an impact, this wave of people turning 65, on everything, on Social Security, on our economy, on the election, on so many different inflection points. What do you think the upshot of this is going to be?
I hope it continues to illustrate and demonstrate what I've certainly been seeing and feeling, which is that this phase of middle life, which I am thinking of as middle age, right? As I turn 60 this year, right? I'm thinking about this as middle age. Definitionally, it isn't. Definitionally, I'm entering old age, right? And so I guess I'm hoping that it starts reframing, right, what people in this age group can do and want to do. And I hope it also helps illustrate for society writ large how important it is to be thinking proactively about this and to help us all understand how easy it is to do when you have 30 or 40 years to plan for it, and how hard it is to do when you don't use that time effectively. And that's true for finances, that's true for social policy programs, that's true for how we spend our time as we age, it's true for our health, right? So whether we get there or not, I don't know, but I think it's going to personalize for so many people in policymaking positions, such a change. And just a quick story, I was recently at my son's engagement party, and I had just come back from, it's very exciting. We're super thrilled. I just come back from visiting my elderly parents, and my son's fiance is got a grandmother who's the same age as my parents, who's in failing health. And we were talking about it. And somehow at this engagement party, right, all of their friends who are in their mid and late 20s were talking about elder care issues and nursing homes and how their parents were dealing with this. And I thought, my husband and I afterwards were like, We didn't talk about that when we were in our 20s, and we sure didn't. My grandparents were going through that. My parents were helping them. I didn't have a clue. I was oblivious to all of that. So I was like, wow, are these just super wonderful kids, which they are? I shouldn't say kids, wonderful adults, which they are. Or is this a difference, right? Is this actually different? And I'm hopeful that it's actually different.
That is amazing. Thank you so much for a terrific and fun, wide-ranging conversation. Anne Lester, the book is Your Best Financial Life. Thank you so much for a great conversation.
Oh, thank you, Jean.
And we'll be right back with Julia and your mailbag. Did you know that women are more likely to outlive our retirement savings than men are? It's true. In fact, it's our biggest financial fear. And this savings gap is where the Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity available from Gainbridge comes in. If you aren't familiar with annuities, the concept is essentially that you take a chunk of money and you turn it into a paycheck that you can start drawing on when you want to, next year or next decade. The Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity caters to women's unique retirement needs. And with a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit and flexible withdrawals, it's like having a paycheck for life. Plus, you'll also get guaranteed returns at 5.95% APY, making the Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity the perfect complement to your existing portfolio. So who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for important information. This is a paid endorsement. Here's one of my money rules. If you can't afford to replace it, insure it. If you can afford to replace it, don't. This rule applies for pretty much all kinds of insurance, and you'll make the right decision on life insurance if you think about it as income insurance. If there are people who depend on your income and they wouldn't be able to replace it without you, buy the life insurance. The good news is life insurance is hugely affordable, but it's one of those things that definitely makes sense to shop around for. The differences can be great. Start by getting a free quote from SelectQuote. SelectQuote has helped people save 50% or more by shopping highly rated insurance carriers for them. In fact, they recently found a 40-year-old woman a $500,000 policy for only $16 a month. They do the legwork and the research for you. Whether you need a $500,000 policy or a $5 million one, their licensed insurance agents can help you find the right policy for you, for your family, and for your budget. If you have people who depend on your income, take a couple minutes today to get your quote. Quotes are completely free and quick to calculate. Go to selectquote.com. That is selectquote.com. Details on the sample rate at selectquote.com. We are back for Mailbag. Julia Chatsky joining me as always. Hey, Jules.
Hello. How's it going?
Going pretty well. So here's a question for you. I mean, you're in your 20s. Do you and your friends ever talk or think about, like, oh my God, am I ever going to be able to retire? Or is that just so far in the future, it's not even on the radar?
I can barely think about what's for dinner next week, let alone tonight. So no.
No. How about Adam? I mean, Adam, Julia's boyfriend,
Adam definitely does.
He's like very future focused.
Yeah. And yet he tells me not to think about the future. So maybe I should point that out sometime. All right. I think we should get into our question because it is a long one this week, but it is probably relevant to many of our listeners. So I think bear with us as we get through the question and then we'll get into it. Does that sound good?
That sounds great.
All right. Our question today comes from Emily. She writes, "Hi, Jean and Julia. I am a huge fan of Her Money and have shared it with many friends. We talk about your episodes together, and I look forward to new episodes every Wednesday. So I am very excited to be submitting a question of my own about planning ahead for health insurance in retirement. I am 45 years old. I am happily single since getting a divorce over 10 years ago, and I have no current or future income or benefits linked to my husband. For planning purposes, assume that I will not remarry. I took your money type quiz on your website. I am a producer, and it sums me up perfectly. Producers can be financially conservative to their detriment. They prefer to minimize their exposure to risk regardless of how much money they have. In addition, I loved your episode with Simone Stolsoff about the good enough job, and because of it, I read his book and believe I do have a good enough job. So, to sum up myself in a nutshell, I'm a risk-averse over-planner with a good enough job. Although there are many benefits that make my job good enough, I think many of them could be replicated elsewhere. However, I am grandfathered into a retirement health insurance benefit that holds me back from considering other opportunities because I worry that this benefit is too good to give up. If I stay with my employer for another 10 years, I will be eligible to participate in the company's health insurance plan whenever I retire, even if that is as early as age 55. In today's dollars, that means I would pay about $230 a month to buy into what I consider an excellent health insurance plan. And although there would still be co-pays and out-of-pocket expenses, my employer would pay the bulk of the monthly premium. I am eligible for this benefit because I have 20 consecutive years of service at my job. If I were to leave and then come back, I would no longer be eligible for it on the same timeline. I make about $85,000 a year, on which I live relatively comfortably. I have a mortgage balance of $80,000, but no other debt, have about $450,000 in my 403B and Roth IRA accounts, and have $25,000 in my emergency fund. I don't expect to be in a place financially to stop working when I'm 55, but I love the idea of having health insurance taken care of so that I could spend my time from age 55 onwards potentially doing part-time work or a lower-paid job about which I am passionate. I recognize that many people may consider my position financially stable, but I'm still afraid to give up this retirement health insurance benefit. I go back and forth between telling myself to stick it out for 10 more years, become eligible for the benefit, and then shift to a job that speaks to my passions or is less stressful. Or, on the other hand, telling myself that life is too short and staying with the job for another 10 years just because of future health insurance benefit seems foolish when there are other jobs that may either pay more or be a better match for my interests now, or maybe even both. All of the older adults in my life seem very impressed with this retirement benefit and caution to me that I shouldn't give it up because even if I get Medicare, it won't be as good as my employer's insurance. I've tried to research health insurance options, but it was hard figuring out what the options would be if I wanted to purchase insurance today, let alone plan for insurance in the future. So, do you have any recommendations for thinking ahead about health insurance and retirement? Are there things I should be doing today to lock into good plans? Is the option I have with my employer rare enough or good enough that it should motivate me to stay with my company for another 10 years? Is there a way to qualify the value of the benefit so that I could calculate how much more I would need to earn in a new job to make up for losing this benefit if I left my company? Do you think I'm being risk averse to my detriment in my typical producer style to put so much weight on this benefit? Thank you so much for considering my questions, and thank you again for all you do. Best, Emily.
Wow. Well, first of all, Emily, thanks for laying all of that out for us. Thank you for taking the money type quiz. I hear from people all the time that they've taken it, and it's available on our website. It's insight into why you are the way you are with money. It's a 40-question diagnostic that was developed by a PhD out in California. We recently had her on the show. You can listen to that if you missed it. And we just hear again and again, oh my God, this got me. And I got to say, Emily, my primary money type is also producer. So I relate to how you are feeling about not wanting to take this risk. I have to push myself to take risks when I feel like I shouldn't be taking them or that I don't want to take them. And in the world of health insurance, where we know that benefits like these are rare, in fact, only about 21% of large companies offer retiree health benefits anymore. And that number has been steadily falling. As recently as 2021, it was 27%. You know, this is something that is worth at least thinking about holding on to. However, 10 years is a really, really long time. I'm about 10 years older than you. Makes me 59. I'm going to be 60 this year. I can't believe I'm saying that, but I'm saying it a lot to remind myself that I'm going to be 60 this year and that it's not so bad. And I got to say, I'm at the age where things are starting to happen to people that I love. People are calling with diagnoses and life changes and unexpected, unhappy surprises. And although I really have never been a live for today kind of a person, I do think there is something to making sure that you aren't putting off the important things until tomorrow. And because work takes up so much of your time, because we spend so much of our lives and our energy at work, I really enjoyed my conversation with Simone Stoltzoff as well. But I don't really subscribe to the good enough job theory. Not for me. I want a job that is meaningful to me. And it sounds like you may want a job that is meaningful to you and that you may want it sooner rather than later. So here's what I would suggest. Don't quit, but start looking. Start looking for a job that speaks to you a little more than the job that you have right now. See what the difference in pay looks like. Consider whether you could continue to, if you get a bump, live on the amount that you are being paid now, and maybe you could put some additional money into a health savings account for the future, or just a regular savings account or an investment account that would allow you to feel a little bit more at ease about your future healthcare costs. And then two other points. The first is when you have a plan like this, plans change. Sometimes companies hit times in their financial lives where they're no longer able to offer such a rich package of benefits, and they switch things up. I'm not saying that this is going to happen. I'm saying that it could happen. And the other thing is, once you are on Medicare, many of these employer plans are supplemental plans. As a general rule, you may first be covered by Medicare, and this employer plan may fade into the background to pick up any gaps. Does that make it not valuable? No, it's still valuable. But you should understand how it's likely to play out in the future. So I would do a little more exploration, Emily, and let us know what you decide. Thanks for writing, and thanks so much for listening. And Julia, thanks for laying that all out so clearly.
You are welcome. Thank you, Emily, for writing such a nice and well thought out question.
Absolutely. If you've got any other money related questions, we'd love to hear from you. Send them our way by emailing us at mailbag@hermoney.com or leave a comment on our YouTube page at Her Money on YouTube. Thanks, Jules.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
We are going to take a quick break. Hey, everybody, it's Jean. If you want to continue unlocking your potential, then you should also check out Think Fast, Talk Smart, produced by our friends at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that received nearly 50 million downloads. It's the number one career podcast in 95 countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression to keeping your nerves in check while speaking to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are critical to business. All that and so much more is available on Think Fast, Talk Smart. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And we're back with your money tip of the week. If you are a longtime user and fan of the free budgeting app Mint,
My condolences. It is shutting down in just a few weeks on March 23rd, but please don't let your budget die along with the app. Mint users may have noticed that their data is being moved over to Credit Karma, which seems like a simple solution, but has some limits. Credit Karma is primarily a credit monitoring site, and while you'll be able to do some expense tracking, you won't be able to categorize or set your monthly budgets. So look at this as a chance to shake things up and try a new budgeting method that may work better for you, because we do know that having a budget in place can help improve your short and long-term financial habits, help with managing debt and saving money, and enable you to reach your financial goals. Now, here's the bad news. If you really like having the aggregation that Mint completed for you, you're probably going to have to pay for it. We recommend doing your research and checking out the alternatives like YNAB, You Need a Budget, Simplify by Quicken, Monarch Money, or Tiller. But there are other options. You can budget your expenses the old school way in a spreadsheet, which means just putting some time on your calendar to look at your different accounts and keep track of that stuff on your own. Thanks so much for joining me today on Her Money. Thanks to Ann Lester for sharing why it's never too late to start planning for a joyful and stress-free retirement.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Edelman Financial Engines. Her Money is produced by Haley Pascalides. This show is mixed and mastered